Judy was boring.
Hello.
Then Judy discovered Chumbacasino.com.
It's my little escape.
Now Judy's the life of the party.
Oh, baby, mama's bringing home the bacon.
Whoa, take it easy, Judy. The Chumba life is for everybody. So go to Chumbacasino.com and play over 100 casino-style games. Join today and play for free for your chance to redeem some serious prizes. Chumbacasino.com. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
It is Ryan here, and I have a question for you. What do you do when you win? Like, are you a fist pumper, a woo-hooer, a hand clapper, a high-fiver? I kind of like the high-five, but if you want to hone in on those winning moves, check out Chumba Casino. At ChumbaCasino.com, choose from hundreds of social casino-style games for your chance to redeem serious cash prizes. There are new game releases weekly, plus free daily bonuses, so don't wait. Start having the most fun ever at ChumbaCasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void or prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.
You are now listening to True Murder, the most shocking killers in true crime history, and the authors that have written about them. Gacy, Bundy, Dahmer, The Night Stalker, BTK. Every week, another fascinating author talking about the most shocking and infamous killers in true crime history. True Murder, with your host, journalist and author, Dan Zupansky.
Good evening. From veteran true crime master Harold Schechter comes a unique look into the history of crime told through the dark objects left behind. The false teeth of a female serial killer from 1908. The cut and paste confession of the Black Dahlia killer. The newly cracked cipher of the Zodiac killer. The shotgun used in the Clutter family murders, which were made famous by Truman Capote's true crime classic, In Cold Blood. These are more than simple artifacts that once belonged to notorious murderers. They are objects of fascination to the legion of true crime obsessives around the world, and not merely for fleeting dark thrills, but because they represent a way to better understand those we typically label monsters in lieu of learning how they actually became one. In Murderabilia, veteran true crime writer Harold Schechter presents 100 murder-related artifacts spanning two centuries, 1808 to 2014, with accompanying stories of various lengths. A visual and literary journey, it presents a history unlike any previously told in the true crime genre, one that speaks to the dark fascination of true crime fans, while also presenting a larger historical timeline of how and why we continue to be captivated by the most sensational crimes and killers among us. The book that we're featuring this evening is Murderabilia, A History of Crime in 100 Objects, with my special guest, American crime historian and author, Harold Schechter. Welcome to the program, Harold Schechter.
Very pleased to be here. Good to talk to you again, Dan.
It's always a great pleasure, Harold. Thank you so much for coming on the program and talking about your latest book, Murderabilia.
Well, thank you. Very proud of the book. Murderabilia, subtitle, A History of Crime in 100 Objects. And I've been very interested in the phenomenon of murderabilia for quite a while. I've kind of mentioned it in other books I've written.
Yes.
This is the first time I've devoted a whole book to it.
Now, you write, you're a historian of American crime. You have long been intrigued by this phenomena, but some people have decried it as a symptom of modern cultural degeneracy. You defend this.
Well, first of all, to define the term for listeners who potentially might not know what it means, murderabilia refers to collectible items, mementos, souvenirs related to very sensational murder cases. And the term was actually coined by a guy named Andy Kahan, who works, he's in Houston, and he's kind of a victim's advocate who works with a police department. And years ago, John Walsh, you know, John Walsh,
yes,
very well known for the program America's Most Wanted, you know, he got involved with all this crime stuff after suffering this horrendous tragedy where his son Adam was abducted from a shopping mall and ended up being murdered by one of the country's most loathsome serial killers.
Yes.
Otis Toole, companion of Henry Lee Lucas. But for a while, John Walsh had an afternoon talk show, and I was invited to be on it with a few people, including Andy Kahan. And Andy, when I talked about seeing murderabilia as a symptom of the degeneracy of contemporary culture, you know, that's kind of the way Andy Kahan saw it.
Right.
He was very antagonistic. And of course, you know, from his point of view and from the point of view of the victims of these crimes, you know, there is something obviously kind of reprehensible about this. But I was there to point out that it wasn't really in any way just a contemporary phenomenon, that if you look back, there's always been this appetite among people to own souvenirs that are connected to these very sensational murders. You know, some of the examples I give in the introduction, there was a very, very famous British murder called the Red Barn Murder, in which this young woman named Maria Martin was seduced and impregnated by a guy who promised to marry her. This is kind of a very common, all too common kind of crime.
Yeah.
An arena somewhere, and he killed her and he buried her in this barn. It was known locally as the Red Barn. And part of what made the story so sensational was that Maria's mother had a dream that her daughter had been killed. You know, she just disappeared, Maria.
Yes.
And supposedly, you know, the guy who murdered her told everybody that, you know, he had taken it off and made an honest woman of her and married her, and she was living somewhere else. After a while, when Maria's mother didn't hear anything from her daughter, she became suspicious, and then she had a dream that Maria had been killed and was buried in this barn, and some people went to look, and sure enough, they dug up her body. And, you know, as is often the case, I mean, it remains the case, huge crowds descended on the site of the murder and, you know, started breaking apart pieces of the barn and taking back as souvenirs. And then when they finally hung the murderer, a guy named Corder, one of the perks of being a hangman in those days was you got to keep the rope.
Wow.
And, you know, these executioners would cut the ropes into little pieces and sell them to spectators as souvenirs. And also Corder was dissected, which was one of the punishments of those for executed murderers. And some of his skin was flayed off his body and it was tanned and made into a tobacco pouch. You know, and stuff like that happened. There's another famous case. These two, William Burke and William Hare, Burke and Hare, they're sort of known as grave robbers, but they didn't. Sure. They actually robbed graves. This was in Scotland, in Edinburgh, and it was a big center of medical schools. And again, there was a shortage of cadavers for anatomy classes. And a lot of these physicians would pay grave robbers to provide them with corpses. So Burke and Hare discovered that it was easy just to murder people and pass them off as the corpses of the newly dead and get paid for them. And
yes.
when they were finally captured and Burke was executed, the same thing happened with Burke. Somebody flayed off some of his skin, tanned it, and made it into a pocketbook. Not a pocketbook in the sense of a purse, but a pocketbook in the sense of a little notebook that people carried in their, doctors carried in their pockets. There's actually a photograph of that Burke notebook in my book. So anyway, the point being, you know, this is a phenomenon that, as far as, you know, has always existed. And in the introduction to my book, I kind of speculate a little bit about what the attraction of owning this kind of macabre artifact might be. And, you know, I kind of see it in some way as being related to saints' relics, sort of the flip side, what a Jungian would call the shadow side of a saint's relic.
Right.
You know, just as a saint's relic, you know, contains this, resonates with this holy power, the murderabilia resonates with this unholy power, which exerts its own kind of dark attraction. So, you know, there are other factors involved. But yeah, I mean, that's what I try to establish in the introduction. that the phenomenon has always existed. You know, nowadays, of course, you could go online. There are these sites where you can, you know, buy a sock puppet made by Charles Manson or whatever. You know, you can buy all this stuff. You know, that's really the only difference between now and then is the easy accessibility of this stuff. But the desire to own these kinds of artifacts goes way, 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 way back. And again, the impulse that leads somebody to want to own it. Again, I think it's complicated, but I think there are these deep, almost superstitious reasons that people want to own these things.
Right. You say, too, that before crime scenes were contained by police, people discarded off valuable evidence and also what they might consider souvenirs.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, absolutely. As I said, with the Red Barn, also with the case of the Bender family in Kansas in the late 1800s, also covered in my book, you know, this family that ran this little kind of roadside tavern in Kansas. And when travelers would stop off there, they would end up getting murdered and robbed and their bodies buried in the apple orchard. But when the Bender atrocities were discovered, again, crowds descended on the place and basically tore down the whole house, you know, taking away pieces of wood as souvenirs. Yeah. So that happened a lot in the old days.
You talk about another dramatic example is Anton Probst in 1866. The barn in which the slaughter took place was overrun with sightseers who made off with, again, the wooden splinters from the blood-spattered floorboards.
Right. Well, they made off with, you know, the bodies in that case. Probst was this very, very, very notorious mass murderer who methodically slaughtered the seven members of the family that he worked for, farm family, and who had treated him very, very well. You know, and he hid their corpses, bloody corpses in the barn and covered them with hay. Yeah. And again, when those crimes were discovered and hordes of people descended on the crime scene, you know, there are people making away with little pieces of hay that had blood stains on them.
Yeah.
So, you know, again, anything they could get their hands on that was a macabre souvenir of this atrocity. So, yeah. And Probst himself, when he was hanged, again, his body was dissected. And somehow, it's a little unclear how, but his preserved arm and hand ended up in a New York dime museum. You know, dime museums were these kind of sleazy exhibitions which lured patrons, you know, by exhibiting just all kinds of bizarre things, you know, freaks, the remains of different kinds of freaks and medical oddities. There was a pornographic peep show element to it because they would have wax models showing female genitalia and so on and so forth. But in this one museum, the New York Anatomical Museum, the owner, the proprietor somehow got hold of Anton Probst's arm and ran newspaper advertisements touting, you know, this amazing artifact, which people could come see for 25-cent admission.
You mentioned these, you call them seedy dime museums, proliferating in the first half of the 19th century, but you also had this, and you mentioned Anton Probst, part of that 20,000 objects of wonder advertised by one of these establishments. And you say even the venerable P.T. Barnum got in the act.
Well, I mean, Barnum was very, 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 very well aware of the extent to which, you know, these crime things could attract customers.
Sure.
You know, there was a guy named Albert Hicks. It was a very sensational crime in the early 1800s, who shipped aboard, as I remember, was like an oyster boat. Anyway, he ended up killing the entire crew. And when he was hanged, Barnum, before Probst went to his death, Barnum made a deal with him and persuaded Probst to leave him the clothing that he was going to be hanged in. And then Barnum made a kind of wax replica of Anton Probst and dressed him in those clothes and, again, drew enormous crowds. Of course, Madame Tussaud, you know, was doing the same thing in originally in France and then in England in her wax museums, you know, what they call the Chamber of Horrors, which were sections of her museums that contained relics and wax recreations. of notorious murders, you know, always attracted the greatest number of paying customers. So
you talk about also P.T. Barnum's Broadway Museum, but you also say that there was a Museum of London exhibit in 2016 that displayed scores of objects from Scotland Yard's legendary collection, properly known as the Black Museum.
Yeah, the London police, you know, they have all these amazing objects connected with very, very, very sensational British crimes. I can't remember all of them. I mean, there have been books published on the subject, kind of weird art books. They did do an exhibition of that in London of, you know, you're talking about artifacts from Jack the Ripper, you know, artifacts from, there's several of these things I cover in my book. There was a British murderer, the Brides in the Bathtub murder. You know, this guy was like a Bluebeard killer who would marry one woman after another and then drown them in the bathtubs and somehow persuade the police that they had died by accident and so on and so forth. You know, so they would have his, they might have one of his bathtubs in the show. Anyway, that's the kind of stuff they would have at what's called the Black Museum.
You write that the ominous significance of some of the objects in this volume, Lizzie Borden's hatchet, for example, and the Luger used by mass murderer Howard Unruh is obvious. But you say that other items, like the ladder used in the Lindbergh baby kidnapping and Augusta Gaines' crucifix, are everyday objects that acquired sinister meaning through the association with notorious homicides.
Well, I'm not sure Lindbergh's, the ladder that was used in the Lindbergh's kidnapping would qualify ordinary object.
Is everyday, you know.
I mean, everybody knows Lizzie Borden, you know, delivered supposedly 40 whacks. 41 to her mother, or maybe vice versa. You know, again, so Howard Unruh, who's considered to be America's first modern mass murderer, went on a shooting spree, I'm going to say 1948, 47, I can't remember the exact date, in his New Jersey hometown, shot and killed 13 of his neighbors very methodically with a World War II Luger he had brought back from the war. Yeah, I mean, it's obvious. You know, it's obvious that that's a weapon that was used by this killer. But yes, there are some other objects. For example, there's a pair of eyeglasses. And if you just look at this pair of eyeglasses, you know, you wouldn't think there was anything particularly special about them. But they turn out to be the pair of eyeglasses that were worn and owned by Richard Nathan Leopold of Leopold and Loeb. And they were the glasses that led to their arrest. Because after Leopold and Loeb abducted and murdered this young boy, they brought him out to this kind of wilderness area and stashed his corpse in a culvert. And in the course of that body disposal, somehow Leopold lost his eyeglasses, which had been in the breast pocket of his jacket. And those were, the, and the, you know, that ultimately led to their arrest. They thought they'd committed the perfect crime. So, yes, there are a number of objects that in and of themselves don't seem to be particularly extraordinary, but in fact, you know, do have this important connection to the crimes. You know, in the book, what I do is I have 100 different objects, each one of which I use as kind of a springboard to talk about the crime that it's related to.
You write also that some of these items also include what you write is the oldest form of true crime literature is the one folklorists call murder ballads.
So murder ballads, you know, which go back before Shakespeare's time, and let's say in 16th century England, when a sensational murder happened, there would be, I won't quite dignify them with the name of poets, but they were sort of would-be poets, you know, who would turn these crimes into ballads. And these things were sometimes set to music, sometimes not. But that's how information about these crimes would be transmitted, would be through these ballads. And then later on, after the invention of the printing press, well, I mean, printing press had already been invented. I mean, initially, these are murder ballads would have been just transmitted orally. And of course, all of those would have been lost to time. But once the printing press was invented, these printers would print up these ballads on what were called broadsides, which were sheets of paper of a certain size, and sell them. And yeah, that became the earliest form of true crime literature. And the murder ballad continued to exist really well into the 20th century. In fact, you know, there are 78 records, one of which, at least one of which I have in the book, recording a contemporary ballad. And, you know, once in the, you're way too young to remember it, this is my time, but in the folk song boom of the late 1950s and early 1960s, you know, a lot of these old murder ballads, you know, were sung and recorded by all these folk groups or people like Bob Dylan. So, yeah, so the murder ballad is a very, very, very centuries-old form of true crime narrative.
Yes, you write that you cite it was called Little Omi, and it was based on the actual crime. You say they took some considerable liberties with the truth, but it was concerning Naomi Wise, and that Bob Dylan and also Elvis Costello, among other people.
Yeah, Omi Wise.
So very, very interesting.
Well, again, Omi Wise, another example of the Maria Martin corridor phenomenon I mentioned before. You know, Omi Wise was another young woman impregnated by some scoundrel and, you know, demanded that he marry her, and instead he murdered her, and that that crime got turned into this ballad. There's a whole genre of ballads. They're called murdered girl ballads that have all, basically all of which have the same, tell the same story. And usually in those ballads is an Omi Wise. I mean, from, you know, the little that's known about the historical Omi Wise, you know, she was a fairly loose living young woman. But typically, as in that case, you know, in the ballad, these victims are turned into virtuous young women who are seduced, you know, by these diabolical lovers, and then murdered. So, yeah, yes, that's the first, you know, that's as far back as my book goes chronologically, is the Omi Wise.
Mm-hmm. You talk about, too, that the you use a term, I guess at the time, eraser killer.
Well, it's the same thing, yeah. Well, somebody, yeah, who, it's in my book. But there was a woman who wrote a book called Erased years ago, which talks about that whole phenomenon. You know, that's still going on, right? You know, you see it, for example, in the case of Scott Peterson. You know, his wife's pregnant. You know, he gets involved with his other, you know, hot young woman who doesn't realize he's married. And instead of getting a divorce and having to pay alimony and child support, you know, he gets rid of his pregnant wife. So, you know, that's a kind of crime that is all too common.
Yes. We talked about the ballads, but also this, it turns into this popular sheet music. And you cited, again, another dramatic example with the little Charlie Ross, who was kidnapped. And a very interesting story about the father trying his whole life to find his son, with to no avail. But this becomes a popular sheet music, definitely. And it was called Bring Back Our Little Darling, I believe. Yeah, Bring Back Our Darling.
Well, the thing about the Charlie Ross kidnapping that makes it significant historically is that it was the first kidnapping for ransom in U.S. history. Mm-hmm. You know, there had been other children who had been snatched, you know, way before. But this time was the first time that his abductors, you know, that a child abductor demanded some money. And, yeah, again, became a very sensational case. There are always, you know, people around were happy to exploit these things. And as you say, yeah, somebody wrote a little song, printed up the sheet music. So, you know, people, probably women for the most part, you know, could take it home and play it on the piano in the evening. You know, it's obviously a kind of tear-jerking song. But yes, I mean, you know, the whereabouts of Charlie were never discovered and remain a mystery. So,
let's use this as an opportunity to stop for a second to hear from our sponsor. Have you ever had to cancel going to a planned party due to bloating? You'd just be too uncomfortable to stay? Well, it shouldn't be embarrassing. It happens to a lot of people. Ritual literally created Symbiotic Plus with issues like this in mind. It contains clinically studied prebiotics, probiotics, and a postbiotic to support a balanced gut biome. My wife Lisa and I first chose Ritual because of the important research they'd done to create their multivitamin. And so now we trust Symbiotic Plus and have added it to our daily regimen. Why include a postbiotic? It provides fuel to the cells that make up the gut lining and supports a healthy gut barrier. Win-win. It has a delayed release capsule design to help survive the harsh conditions of the upper GI tract for delivery to the colon, an ideal place for probiotics to grow and thrive. It's all in one single nested minty capsule, no refrigeration needed, so it's easy to take with you when you travel. Symbiotic Plus and Ritual are here to celebrate, not hide, your insides. There's no more shame in your gut game. That's why Ritual is offering my listeners 30% off during your first month. Visit ritual.com/murder to start Ritual or add Symbiotic Plus to your subscription today. Now let's get to some of these items and a little bit of the story, just a little bit of the story behind it. What's interesting is that I cite your number 12, and that's Harper's Weekly. Illustration of Alfred Packer's victims. You call the Colorado, or they were, he was called the Colorado Cannibal. But its significance, this Harper's Weekly, tell us what was its significance.
Well, I've actually written a whole book about Packer called Maneater. So Packer was part of a group of silver miners who headed into the Colorado Rockies. There was a kind of gold rush and silver rush in the area, you know, hoping to strike it rich. And he and his companions became snowbound, and Packer was the only one to emerge. And he claimed that he had gotten frostbite, and the other guys, I forget if there were five or six of them, had left him, you know, but he had managed to, somehow survive and emerge. But people were immediately suspicious of his story, partly because he looked unusually well-fed for somebody who had survived long. Anyway, what happened was that I can't remember how much time elapsed, but it was some months later in the spring that an illustrator, Harper's Weekly at that time, was a very, very popular magazine. And, you know, this is obviously pre-electronic era, no TV, no radio, nothing else, you know, where people bought lots of magazines to keep them informed and entertained. And Harper's Weekly was a very, very popular one,
right.
Featured a lot of illustrations. And an artist for Harper's Weekly was doing a piece on the Colorado Rockies, and he came upon this gruesome sight, which were these decomposed skeletal remains of these miners. And, you know, quickly became clear that they had all been murdered. And there was evidence as well that flesh had been stripped from their skeletons and consumed. So Packer was arrested. People sometimes say that he was first person ever tried for cannibalism in the United States, but that's actually inaccurate, because cannibalism is actually, you know, wasn't and may not still in and of itself remain illegal in the United States. It certainly was. And I mean, you know, mutilating a corpse was illegal, but there were no laws about cannibalism per se. But, you know, he was arrested, charged with murder. He entered into the folklore of the West. I taught for a year at the University of Colorado, and the student cafeteria was known as the Alfred Packer Cafe.
Wow.
So he's the guys who did South Park. They did a great movie about Alfred Packer before they became famous and rich from South Park. I think it's called Alfred Packer the Musical. Tells the story pretty accurately, except for all the musical and comic interludes. Yeah, but I reprint the very famous Harper's Weekly illustration as one of the objects in my book. And it's very, the illustration, even to modernize, I mean, we're used to all kinds of very, very graphic images from slasher, still a very, very disturbing image. Yeah. And you imagine the impact it must have had on people back, you know, back in the, when it was published.
You have some other examples similar to that. You're number 18. You have the front page of the National Police Gazette. Early example, you cite, of a serial killer groupie, a woman named the Sweet Pea Girl.
I'm not sure that was her actual name. But yes, that was from the case of Theodore Durant. This is San Francisco in the late 19th centuries. Durant was a very handsome, intelligent, church-going medical student who was also a serial sex killer who lured a couple of his women acquaintances he knew from church to his church and murdered them and raped their bodies after death and then stashed their bodies inside the church. He brought one of them up to the belfry and his crimes were discovered. He became known to the press as the Demon of the Belfry. But it was an early example of a phenomenon, again, that has become very familiar. You know, we now call serial killer groupies. As I'm sure you know, no matter how loathsome and reprehensible a serial killer is, seems to attract a number of women romantically, some of whom actually end up marrying him. So, yeah, so there was this very attractive young woman who every day of Durant's trial would bring him a little bouquet of sweet pea flowers. And she became known, as you say in the press, as the sweet pea girl. And I reproduce the front page. The National Police Gazette was kind of the sensational tabloid newspaper at the time that reported different notable crimes that were happening throughout the country and included various graphic illustrations. So yeah, that's another of the objects.
Mm-hmm. You have everything from Belle Guinness's false teeth, and that might be questionable if they are, but that Belle Guinness's false teeth.
There's no question, by the way. They're definitely her. They're definitely her teeth.
Okay, sorry.
It's actually a piece of bridge work that the local dentist in Laporte testified that he had made for Belle and installed in her mouth. So there's no question about the authenticity of the teeth. Hmm. The question was, did Belle remove that bridge work and leave it? When their house burned down, they found, for your listeners, I mean, Belle Guinness, known as the Lady Bluebeard, was this woman, a Norwegian immigrant, who had murdered a couple of husbands for their insurance money and then bought a big farm in the farming community of LaPorte, Indiana, and started putting matrimonial ads in Scandinavian newspapers, luring lonely Norwegian bachelors who were instructed to bring all their money with them to her farmhouse, where she would murder them and chop them up and bury their bodies in her yard. And when the law was closing in on her, her house mysteriously burned down, and investigators found in the remains of the cellar her charred corpse, but it was head. There was no head. But they brought in a Yukon gold miner to sift through the ashes, and he's the one who discovered that bridge work, which, as I say, the dentist testified belonged to Belle, but they never found a head. So a lot of people believed, and some continue to believe, that in fact the body in the basement, in the cellar, was not in fact Belle's, that she had somehow lured a woman of her approximate stature to the farm and murdered her and used her as a decoy and left her teeth there to convince people that it was in fact her and she had escaped.
You have a page from Carl Panzram's handwritten confession. You also have number 87, Ivan Milat action figure. This guy's a notorious Aussie mass murderer, and this is an action figure from Ivan Milat.
Well, I wanted to include at least for better or for worse, I have come into possession of a number of such action figures. I have like an Albert Fish action figure and other. Again, there is this, I wouldn't call it an industry, maybe a cottage industry. There can go online and find these very, very, what I'm sure many people regard as very inappropriate collector's items. There are these different action figures, different serial killer action figures. So I wanted to include at least one in the book, and the Milat one was the one I chose. But yeah, Milat was a very good Australian horror movie called Wolf Creek, which some of your listeners may have seen, which was kind of based on Milat. He would pick up these hitchhikers in Australia and do horrible things to them and murder them. So
you have some other dramatic examples, obviously, here. Danny Rowling's artwork, the Gainesville Ripper, Robert Picton's chainsaw, the pig farmer killer. Very interesting, number 90, Susan Smith's self-portrait. Why is this so interesting, this self-portrait?
Well, when you look at the self-portrait, you think it's done by a five-year-old, but in fact, it was done. Susan Smith, you know, is the woman who was dating a guy. She had two kids from a previous marriage. She was dating a guy who didn't want to raise her kids. So she took her kids for a drive and strapped them to the back seat of her, to the kids' seats in the back of the car, and sent the car into a lake, drowning her children, and then claimed that the car had been carjacked by some black guy. So yeah, she ended up in jail, and she does these in her correspondence. She'll often include a little self-portrait of her looking. It's a, you know, smiley face stick figure. Again, that look, it might have been done by a five-year-old. Mm-hmm. And there's something, especially when you realize that it was done by this middle-aged woman who had cold-bloodedly and horribly murdered her own two children. You know, it achieves a special kind of creepiness. No?
Yes, absolutely. Speaking of creepiness, you have number 93, the wooden rail fence, the one that Matthew Shepard was trapped upon.
Sure. You know, many of your listeners know the story of Matthew Shepard, this young guy who was taken by two male acquaintances who beat him up and, well, you know, beat him mortally and left him tied to this fence to die. Yeah, so there's a picture of that fence. You know, Shepard has become a kind of martyr of the rights movement. You know, very, very, very horrific, appalling crime. So,
absolutely. Let's use this as an opportunity to stop to hear these messages.
Judy was boring.
Hello.
Then Judy discovered Chumbacasino.com.
It's my little escape.
Now Judy's the life of the party.
Oh, baby, mama's bringing home the bacon.
Whoa, take it easy, Judy. The Chumba life is for everybody. So go to ChumbaCasino.com and play over 100 casino-style games. Join today and play for free for your chance to redeem some serious prizes. ChumbaCasino.com. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
You have some very interesting other exhibits or items here. Number 94, the weapons belonging to Eric Harris and Dylan Klebold for the Columbine Massacre. You also have Armin Muiz, mispronouncing his name, but a shirt swatch.
Yeah, well, I'm not sure how to pronounce. I think you did as good a job as I would pronouncing his name. You know, that object is the kind of thing, again, you can buy on these murderabilia websites now. I'm not sure how they obtain these kinds of objects, but, you know, they package them in little cards. Yes, but Muiz was interested in eating somebody. He put an ad on some weird website looking for somebody who wanted to be eaten. Found somebody. The guy, you know, came and stayed with Muiz and allowed himself to be mutilated and devoured. Apparently, you know, parts of him were eaten while he was still alive. Victim even partook in some of the meals.
Wow.
He was ultimately killed. So.
Jesus.
Yeah. You know, the people like Muiz become these very, 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 very dark celebrities in certain kinds of subcultures.
Sure. You have number 96, very, very interesting item, Scott Peterson's boat, of all things.
You know, we were just talking about Scott Peterson a little while ago in another prime example of what the author, whose name I forget, calls an eraser killer. So that's apparently how he disposed of his wife's pregnant body, was taking her out of this boat and dumping her in the ocean.
Yeah, incredible. You have John Allen Muhammad's Bushmaster rifle. Very interesting case, of course, the sniper. And number 98, I thought very, very interesting, was this Grim Sleeper billboard, being one of the, other than the Long Island serial killer, Grim Sleeper was the last known serial killer of any, I guess, importance. Tell us about this Grim Sleeper billboard.
Again, Grim Sleeper, this African-American guy who had a very long and unfortunately prolific career as a serial killer, you know, preying on women, many of them sex workers. And, you know, when it became clear that there was a serial killer at large, it became clear that all these women had gone missing. Los Angeles County put up these billboards Have you seen these women? If you know anything about these women, you know, please come forward. There's a reward for information. I think the billboard that I reproduce in the book was one that was put up after the Grim Sleeper was finally captured, you know, announcing that, you know, those disappearances had been solved.
Right.
I think, I can't remember actually what's in the book.
Mm-hmm. You have items like the Scotland Yard diagram of the Blackwell bathtub, the brides in the bath murders we mentioned. Also, number 28, Peter Curtin's mummified head, the vampire of Dusseldorf, subject of a Fritz Lang famous movie, M. You have this Henry Landrell's oven, you call the Bluebeard of Paris. Sheet music to Gallows Song, sung by Carl Wanderer, the Ragged Stranger. You have Nathan Leopold's, you mentioned this, his eyeglasses that fell at the crime scene.
Yeah.
This Reverend Hall's calling card. You have this very interesting number 36, Tom Howard's ankle camera, the Double Indemnity murders.
Yeah.
What was the photo he was able to take? Very, very fascinating item, this one.
So that's related to, there were three very, very sensational murder cases in the 1920s. There was Leopold and Loeb. There was one of the ones you just mentioned, the Hall Mills murder case, where this Episcopalian minister and his choir girl lover were murdered in New Brunswick, New Jersey. And then there was what is sometimes called the Double Indemnity murder, because it was the inspiration for James M. Cain's famous noir novel, Double Indemnity, which was then made into what's often regarded as the first film noir, Billy Wilder's Double Indemnity. That case involved a Queens housewife named Ruth Snyder, who embarked on an affair with this kind of mousy, married little girdle salesman named Judd Gray, and they conspired to murder Ruth's husband. You know, he was a little bit of a brute, and, you know, Ruth was eager to get away with him. Anyway, the case became this huge, huge national obsession, partly because Ruth was seen by so many people at the time as representing the freewheeling, sexually liberated 1920s flapper type, was a threat, you know, to all the traditional standards of domesticity and so on and so forth. And when she was found guilty, the public really demanded that she be executed. So the New York Daily News brought in this well-known photographer named Tom Howard from Chicago, newspaper photographer, and managed to get him like a front row seat at the execution. And he came in with this little camera strapped to his ankle with a cable running up the pants leg. And there was a little switch in the pocket. And at the moment that the executioner threw the switch on the electric chair, Tom Howard snapped this photograph, which became and remains the most famous photograph in tabloid history. It appeared on the front page of the next day's Daily News, headline in enormous type, as dead, above the photograph of Ruth at the moment that the electricity hit her. I believe that that's in the book too, that photograph.
Yes, it is. Yeah.
They actually made dramatic. A movie kind of based on Tom Howard called Picture Snatcher. A movie with Jimmy Cagney, which is very, very, very good. So.
Yeah, it's interesting. The camera is about the size of a GoPro camera strapped to his ankle.
Right. And of course, you know, nobody could see it. Back then, men were pretty long and baggy. So he just pulled up his pants leg and then snapped that picture.
Yeah, incredible. You have number 38, another item very, very interesting for people that know a little bit about Albert Fish, this pelvic x-ray, where it shows all of the things he shoved into his body and he didn't swallow them. So,
Well, the one form I actually saw, I was doing some research in the Library of Congress about a year ago in the archives of the psychiatrist who examined Fish before his trial. Mm-hmm. And they had the actual, I came across the actual x-ray, which is life-size. But yeah, I mean, you know, Fish, who was, as the psychiatrist said, practiced every known perversion.
Yeah.
Along with some that nobody ever heard of. He was this incredible sadist and masochist. You know, Fish said he just enjoyed everything that hurt. After his arrest, his guards noticed that when he sat on the edge of his cot in his cell, he seemed very uncomfortable. And he said it was because he had all these needles shoved up between his legs. and nobody believed him. So they took him to the prison infirmary, took that x-ray, which shows 27 needles of varying sizes floating around his bladder region. You know, fish, again, one form of his very, very, very depraved pleasure was to insert these needles into his perineum and just leave them in his body.
You have a few items that people would recognize as well. Very, very interesting. Al Capone's rap sheet. Bonnie and Clyde's death car, all bullet ridden. Also have, we mentioned Gwyneth Ruth's, the trunk murders, the actual baggage. You have John Dillinger's wooden gun. And also the death mask of the Mad Butcher, Cleveland Torso Killer.
It's not the death mask of the Mad Butcher, because nobody knows who he was. It's
of the victim, yeah.
Yeah, it's one of the victims, yeah.
Yes, pardon me, yeah. You also have number 48, the hand-carved wooden box by Robert Irwin, another one of your book subjects, The Mad Sculptor.
Well, that actually I own. You know, there are a couple of items that I own in the book, but that is one I own. Yeah, so Robert Irwin, who committed this very, very notorious triple murder in New York City on Easter Sunday, 1937, was a very, very talented sculptor. He was also totally crazy. But when he was in and out of mental institutions, he would make pocket money, you know, to spend as a concession by selling different art objects to the nurses, to the attendants, to the doctors. Sometimes he would make sculpted busts of them. After my book came out, I got contacted by this very nice woman from down south who said that she'd read my book and that her husband had been a guard at one of these facilities and had purchased from Irwin this hand-carved box that he had made. And she sent me pictures of it. It's a beautiful object.
Yes.
Every side of it, the top and all four sides, Irwin had carved this bas-relief image of this naked woman, who it turns out was this woman named Ronnie Gideon, who was one of the people he ultimately strangled to death. Anyway, she said, oh, you know, I think my husband would want you to have this. So, you know, I arranged to buy it from her, flew her to New York, purchased it from her. So, yeah, I have a photograph of it, although the photograph doesn't do it fully justice. It's actually quite large box. And, you know, when you see it in actual wood, it's pretty remarkable.
Yes. You have 100 items. We did mention one of the more famous items, John Wayne Gacy's clown self-portraits.
Yeah.
But all of these items are discussed in your new book, Murderbilia. You say we still continue to be captivated by the most sensational crimes and killers among us. And that is the subject of your book, Murderbilia, A History of Crime in 100 Objects. I want to thank you very much, Harold, for coming on and talking about Murderbilia. And for those that might want to take a look, they could probably go to Amazon and see your vast array of books that you've written for the last, I won't say how many years, 40 years?
Yeah, about right. 30-something anyway.
Absolutely. I want to thank you so much for coming on and talking about Murderbilia, A History of Crime in 100 Objects. Thank you so much, Harold Schechter, for this interview, and you have a great evening.
Well, thank you, Dan. Always good talking to you.
Always great talking tonight.
Bye.